Or Tesla coil. You're arcing over something like a pole pig transformer. You're getting something like 13 kilovolts out of the winding of the transformer. That's going through some kind of a spark gap, and the spark gap on each one of those discharges is dumping amperes into that primary winding of your high-powered Tesla coil. And then after it's stepped up by the thousands of turns of the secondary, that great big cylindrical tube down the center, out of the top comes, let me pick a number, 300,000 volts at a few milliamperes. But in order to fire that primary correctly, you're putting in spikes of many amperes at very high voltages. No reasonable size Van de Graaff generator or Wimshurst machine can do that, John. There's a huge impedance mismatch there. So if we're going to combine the two machines, we don't do it on the primary, we do it on the secondary. By some means, I take that coil, the resonant coil of the secondary of a Tesla coil, let me drop, and the bottom of it normally is grounded to earth. In theory, I could ground that to a Van de Graaff generator or a Wimhurst machine. And now I can get the addition of high voltage DC and the high voltage AC simultaneously. I think that's one way we could do it. But it's got to be done at the secondary, otherwise the huge impedance mismatches tells me the Tesla coil will stop working. Tesla coil. Over to you, John.
But to get the effect of the secondary part of that coil, you would need a collapsing field, which the Van de Graaff is going to be continuous, so you would have to have some kind of collapse of field to get the effect of the multiplication of the turn ratio.
Yeah, I think you've got something here. When the air breaks down on the normal operation of a Tesla coil, at the instant before the air breaks down, you've got some huge positive voltage, we'll say, coming out of the top tip of the Tesla coil. Air breaks down, brings that voltage back down to a very low voltage real fast. That half cycle collapses, the arc goes away, the mean free path of the air molecules and the plasma you just made is such that within a nanosecond, I think, plasma is gone. Now you're swinging down to the negative half cycle, and now the probe at the top has enough negative voltage to break down the air and start the process on the second half cycle. And so if I had enough DC voltage simultaneously with the AC voltage, you wouldn't get extinguishing. Without extinguishing, I think you wouldn't carry through to the other half cycle. What do you think, John?
No, I think you're right, Dick, because without a flux change, we wouldn't get a benefit out of that coil. That's my opinion.
Now, it would be interesting to start a Van de Graaff generator running, and with either power supplies, Wimhurst or Van de Graaff or whatever, slowly raise the voltage at the base of the secondary coil of the Tesla coil and see what happens. And do it with positive voltage and negative voltage. Guarantee you'll see two entirely different effects. And these beautiful high voltage machines are not that expensive. Each one of the guys becomes enthusiastic about a Van de Graaff, a Wimhurst, or a Tesla, and rarely does a person own all three and start combining them. Think about that, John. To our knowledge, no one has ever put the machines together in the right combination to see what happens. You could say that Thomson and Tesla were sort of doing this with their Thomson discharge tubes. They were sort of putting AC and DC in various combinations inside of that vacuum to see what happens. But we have a chance of doing it. You and I have the resources to own all three machines, and we can start combining them. KC2WGB. We got to find another place to drain our money, John. K2RIW.
Oh, yes, I got a long list of money drains. But, Dick, think about this. Supposing we were to take the Van de Graaff generator and couple it through an interrupter circuit, like, say, just a spinning disc, which would allow the arc to transmit to the coil and then be gone again, but say we do it once every half second, that should give us a field. Yeah, I think that might work. sort of like a spark gap.
Yeah, mechanically you got a problem though. A really good Van de Graaff generator on the upper bowl generates 200 kilovolts. And you want to build some kind of an interrupter between that 200 kilovolts on that bowl and something else, whether it be a Tesla coil or whatever. And the 200 kilovolt signal, positive voltage, is capable of arcing, oh, about 5 inches. If it will draw a 5-inch arc in air, and you want to cyclically interrupt that,
it's not in the air.
Yes, I can do it.
What would you use for an interrupter? What would that, let's see, in the case of light interrupting, what do you call that wheel that's got teeth on it that allows the light to flow through? You know what I mean. What would you use as an interrupter, John? Go ahead.
Okay, just like a photo interrupter, I would take, say, an LP record, which I've done, and put a pin through it, and space two electrodes 5 inches apart, 6 inches apart, so it doesn't arc, but make the pin long enough that as that rotation comes up, it causes the arc. Follow that?
Okay. Because Teflon, a good thick sheet of Teflon, has, let me think, I think it's something like 300 million volts per inch of electrostatic, of a dielectric strength. If I made an interrupter, first of all, these round wheels...
Thanks for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, code number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
I know it sounds like Rube Goldberg.
Yeah. What do you call that interrupter that they use to measure the speed of light? It's a wheel with a bunch of notches around the perimeter, and you rotate it at just the right rate. There's a name for that interrupter. What's it called, John?
Well, Michelson Morley used that in their experiments. I don't remember. I remember it was a photo interrupter. I don't remember exactly.
It's got a name. But if I build that out of a very thick sheet of Teflon, which has got a very high dielectric strength, I think I can take the voltage out of a Van de Graaff generator and cyclically interrupt it as I rotate that wheel. What do you think, John?
Shutter.
It is a kind of a shutter, but the Michelson-Morley experiment by which they measured the speed of light, you had this round wheel with square teeth around the perimeter where there was open circuit and closed circuit. What's the name of that rotary wheel thing, Eric? Go ahead.
Nickel slot.
I've always known it as a shutter. Right, there's another name for it. We use it in most of our optical controls. You know, even the knob on your radio uses a a pair of interrupted LEDs with two different masks on it, so that way you can tell what direction it's going.
Yeah, that's called a shaft encoder.
Make the interrupter?
The thing that you're talking about, Eric, is called the shaft encoder. And so, but the encoder function itself, the tooth wheel, it's got a fancy name, but I think we could build it out of Teflon, and I think it could be interrupting the 100 or 200 kilovolts out of a Van de Graaff generator, John. Go ahead.
You're right, Dick. I built one similar, not at those voltages, but very similar. My problem was getting a belt long enough to get the operating motor far enough away so that didn't get blasted away. But it did work, and I think that would work in a setup like that with the Van de Graaff and a large coil, and it would be interesting to see what the amplification would be.
Now, hold on now. When you say amplification, the Tesla coil is typically running at something like 1 megacycle of rate on that secondary. I don't think you and I can make the tooth wheel thing operate anywhere near a megacycle, John. Go ahead.
Well, if you were to use a large enough disk with enough points on it that would allow the voltage to feed through it, I think the rotational speed would get up to an area that would allow the Van de Graaff to rebuild its charge. Or we might have to take a slight average of that, but the voltage increase on that secondary coil would be interesting to measure, I believe.
I know what you could use.
I try to make those teeth come and go every microsecond. No matter how big that wheel is, I think those teeth are moving at the speed of sound, way beyond the speed of sound. What do you think, Eric? Go ahead.
You need high impedance, high voltage, and low leakage. Why not a deuterium-filled thyrotron? I don't want that for that.
Okay. The thyrotron, once you turn it on, conducts beautifully, but you've got to remove the voltage to make it go into the non-conducting mode. Is there a tri-state version, you know, these five-layer devices, what are they called now? Silicon-controlled rectifiers. There's a silicon-controlled switch. If they don't go high enough in voltage, does the thyrotron you talk about, is there a version of that that is a silicon-controlled switch where I can order it to be non-conducting? Go ahead.
Yeah. And I think the recovery time of the tube that I use to protect the tube is something like 10 microseconds.
So are you controlling the control grid of that tube to do that? And is there a gas discharge going on inside?
Yeah, there's a gas discharge going on inside, but there's also there's actually two grids in that tube. And I'm trying to remember how it works. They explained it to me once. It's, in essence, like turning the conductivity, turning the ionization on and off like a switch.
But I got a little bit of a problem now. You said it takes 10 microseconds. That means the whole cycle is going to be 20 or more microseconds. That's 50 kilohertz. I'm trying to operate my Tesla coil at a megacycle. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, that's too slow, isn't it? Well, we do have semiconductors that operate at 10,000 or 100,000 volts, but they're humongous devices.
Canadian Hydro, a good buddy of mine, ham radio operator, VE4MA, I think is his call letters, they are transmitting 1 megavolt DC across 1,000 miles. From one hydro station to another population center. And they are able to, with the equivalent of solid-state silicon-controlled switches, they take the 1 megavolt of DC and interrupt it. They make an inverter to convert it into 60-cycle AC. So 1 megavolt solid-state switching devices do exist. I guarantee they are massive in size, massive in local capacitance, high in dollars, and out of our ballpark. Over to you, Eric.
Yeah, they're out of our ballpark. They are huge, though. I have the UPSs that are, 125, 200 kVA, and the semiconductors they use in there, they're small. I mean, we don't really consider it. I mean, when we, like in our radios, the power transistor that generates 50 watts or 25 watts, when you open it up, you find out that there's like a whole bunch of transistor substrates all mounted on a hunk of metal running in parallel. So that's how they increase its current capability. But as far as voltage goes, I don't know exactly what they do.
Yeah, run this by again. You've got a 300 kilovolt uninterruptible power supply. Wow. I presume that's in order to glide you through a interruption from Con Ed or Luco. And if Luco or Con Ed goes down, I guess you've got to generate with your UPS 300 kilowatts of 60 cycle power, and you've got to do it for a long enough period of time to start up a standby diesel generator. Is that approximately what you've seen, Eric? Go ahead.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Actually, one of two generators will pick, and each one of the generators is 3/4 of a megawatt, because it supplies the entire building, not just us.
Yeah, you used to be in a 22-story building on 8th or 9th Avenue, as I remember. Did you have that kind of standby power in that building, Eric?
Yeah, but in that building, we had it in the form of a flywheel.
Now, I remember when Bill Baker brought me down to the Con Ed transformer in the basement, which was a massive structure. Where was that flywheel in that building located, Eric?
Well, I was upstairs behind master control. You know, only the critical stuff because it was small. It was a lever, you know. It's a big freaking hunk of metal hooked up to a motor and a generator.
Roughly how big in diameter was that flywheel? And could that supply half a megawatt for some reasonable number of seconds?
Nah, that thing was barely 10 kilowatts, I don't think. I mean, it was big, but it didn't produce the kind of juice that the UPSs do. I mean, you know, I got like 6 racks of batteries in the UPS. It'll run, that particular one will run 125 kVA for about an hour.
I think you're saying that's the one you're using right now, is that true?
Yeah, that's one of them. There's another one, because they moved the station to 50th Street, but Master Control is still on 35th Street, so we got a bigger one at 50th Street, even though we don't need it, but yeah. That stuff runs for a while. You know, you should think about the World Trade Center and on the 108th floor where, whatchamacallit, I can't remember the name of their company. They were the big firm, and they had a UPS there that was huge. It took up almost half the floor. And that was to run all their computers and stuff. And air conditioning.
Were the batteries for that UPS also on that floor, Eric?
Yeah, well, that's what most of the room was taken up by.
How in the world did those batteries not exceed the floor rating in pounds per square foot?
Well, it's kind of like the same thing we did at Empire when we bought the transmitted power supplies in and, Empire isn't a steel structure building the way you think of it. It's really made out of brick around steel. You increase the load structure of the floor by adding steel.
Now, in the case of the World Trade Center, I think they came close to a failure many years earlier because the Bell Northern Telephone Company wanted permission to put a tremendous number of batteries on floor number 22, and they were going quite far above the floor rating. And they got around the problem by putting I-beams on the floor at right angles to the I-beams that were already in the floor. But I've never heard about anybody telling me that they properly connected them to the vertical walls on the outside. As such, I think they came somewhat close to getting a failure. Over to you, Eric.
Well, you know, the building was constructed in different parts of the building differently. There were some areas that tended to take a lot of weight. But, you know, it's like anything. You can take beams that are laid out horizontally and block them. And by blocking them, you distribute the weight across more of the surface. So, in essence, the load becomes more evenly distributed, and it's not like it's like you have a single load point.
I'll agree you can distribute the load, but if the ultimate thing that supports the load is the vertical beams at the perimeter of the building, and when you see all of those L brackets that had failed in that building, you know that those L brackets were really inadequate. So if the added I-beams under the batteries were not connected to the vertical walls, then I think they were coming dangerously close to failing the L brackets that were on the real beams of the floor. Over to you, Eric.
KTKEY, I'll tell you all about it.
But I know there were certain floors where they were attached to the vertical wall because they knew about it before, you know, as they were building the building, they designed it for it.
Beautiful. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, we were called in, my company. Cantor Fitzgerald had this UPS system because at one time the power failure when we had here the blackout, it put them all out of business for 3 days before they got the computers and everything up and running. So they went ahead and they put in these batteries, and I mean these were batteries. I got scared when I went up to that battery room up there, and these batteries were like plastic case batteries, lead acid with hydrometer built in on the end. And what they did tap into the wall on the corners there to pick the vertical supports up to support these batteries. But I got scared when I saw that because they wanted the surveillance system so that they could see who was going into that battery room area for because of, you know, worrying about some kind of sabotage or whatever, Dick. But it was something to behold. I don't know, even with the connection to the vertical members there, to how this building could withstand that kind of weight, over.
Just people I was talking about.
Yeah, what's your guess as to the rough weight or the number of those batteries that you're describing? Those are very heavy batteries. And how sturdy were those L-brackets that connected the new floor beams under the batteries to that wall? Or were the batteries hanging from the wall itself? How was that done, Mel? K2KEY, K2RIW?
Like the batteries were elevated off the floor. It was like a sort of like in the back there was a beam, looked like, I think, if I remember correctly, it was like a beam that went across the back wall. The batteries were along the wall edge. Was it around all the edges? I think it was two edges, the three edges. I don't remember now exactly. There was like a grid, like a honeycomb thing that came out where the batteries were sitting on, and the front was like a honeycomb type, like a sort of like a crisscross type of framing that was where the batteries sat on this like sort of shelf, I guess you can call them, elevated about, I don't know, maybe about 2 feet or something off the floor. But these batteries, they were massive. They were clear. You could actually look in through the batteries. They were plastic case batteries with hydrometers built right on the end of them, Dick, to indicate the condition of the battery charge, over.
I've seen those kind of batteries. Roughly how many of them, and describe the size of one of them, Mel. Were they about 3 or 4 feet high, each one of them, and 2 feet square at the base, something like that, and roughly how many of them? And what did that bracket connected to the wall look like? Over to you, Mel.
Quite some time ago, so I'm just trying to recall. Yeah, the batteries were big. They stood, those batteries stood at least maybe 4 feet tall, and, maybe 4 by 4 by 4, I would say, easily, with massive terminals on top of them. And the bracket that was holding it looked like, well, how do I describe the bracket? It looked like a beam that more or less was some way secured to both the wall and to the edge. I think it looked like it went from wall to wall, in other words, right across. It wasn't sitting in the middle. And what the heck else did they have? They had their panel, I guess that was the inverter panel that sat on the other side there, and it was some very heavy equipment. That's all I remember, Dick. I remember when the building coming down, I said, oh my God, with those batteries came loose, that was the first thing that jumped in my mind, Dick, over.
Common, Dick.
Yeah, John recognized, but first, Mel, what kind of a fan was used to exhaust the air from that room? You charge those kind of batteries, you make an extremely explosive mixture. Over to you, Mel.
I remember correctly, above the system there was a ductwork. I think that must have been the vacuuming system to get the hydrogen that was, you know, escaping from the batteries, venting out the hydrogen. There was like a... The batteries themselves, nothing was connected to the top of the batteries other than cabling. But above it was, I remember, I think it was ductwork, if I'm not mistaken, with like a grid, ductwork, in other words, was like, the bottom was like screens, Dick, over.
Hey, Mel, remember that room had negative pressure?
KC2WYE.
Outside, that warned you that, what was the, that sign outside that something was being released in a room periodically, Eric? I don't remember what that was, over.
Yeah, they had a halon system in there. I think every hour or something, it's self-tested. It gets a little slight release. It also reduces the oxygen in the air.
Well, we've got John and Eric number two in that order. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead.
Dick, that's a great point you guys are bringing up. You know, you think about the structural guys who built that structure. You have all of those batteries up there. No matter what kind of bracing you do, as you said, it winds up going to the vertical elements to the ground. But just think, without the proper gusseting being done before, the radius of gyration on those columns is going geometrically out. So what happens? Minor earthquake. It just makes you wonder. That is a great subject.
And the building also...
The building moves about 6-8 inches.
Yeah, the building also has a damping structure that supposedly controls the sway, and it's based on a certain time constant or mass at the top of the building. You add all these batteries, and you're disturbing all that. Let's see. John, did you get a chance yet? Yeah, John just got his chance, and now Eric number two. KC2WIE, go ahead, Eric number two.
Yes, Dick. What Mel's probably describing is that structure that contains the battery cells, simply called the battery rack. And what you're referring to as batteries are actually probably lead acid cells, which in their totality compose the battery. Back to you.
If you think about what the vertical supports on the perimeter of the building and also the very center of the building had a support, just the concrete that's poured on each floor. Each floor is approximately 1 acre of area. I don't know what the exact thickness of the concrete was, but if someone told me it was 1.5 feet thick, I would believe it. And concrete is 150 pounds per cubic foot. So you get 9 million pounds of just concrete on each individual floor. And now you add another X number of millions of pounds of batteries. Wow. We're playing with some pretty high energy physics here, and I can see what was going through Mel's mind when he sees all of that chemistry of all of those batteries and all of that mass in the top of the building near Cantor Fitzgerald, all of it coming down at the speed of light when that building collapsed, and all that acid being sprayed all over the place. That plus crushed concrete and everything else all being mishmashed together. Can you see why the lungs of those people who tried to do rescue in that area ran into problems? K2RIW listening. I'm reasonably sure, and maybe you got an opinion on this one, Eric, but that building contained more mass of concrete than steel. The steel is what really held it up, but I think it contained more concrete in pounds than steel. And 110 floors at 9, that building was roughly half a billion pounds, each building.
Don't forget the center core.
Agreed, but even so, there was more concrete than steel in pounds in that building. Roughly half a billion pounds of stuff in each one of those buildings, descending from roughly, 1,500 foot of altitude. Boy, is there a lot of kinetic energy there, a lot of potential energy being released in a hurry.
Question, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John. I mean, Wesley.
I'm sorry coming back to the subject, but a question for you. Is the magnetic field capable of creating molecular heat?
Okay, please reword the question.
We have, in electromagnetic wave, we have electrical, let's say, in the examples that I was describing, the electrical component is vertical, the magnetic one is horizontal. Now, with the proper extent of the amplitude, the magnetic one, goes into the evacuated envelope of glass. Now the circle is there. The circle is plasma. In order to establish the world origins for that plasma, we've got to know how the structure works. We're trying to find what is the positioning on it. But question is, if we know for sure that the magnetic component horizontally enter into that envelope and then we have a plasma, my question is the magnetic component or magnetic field capable of creating molecular heat? And to exist?
I think this is related to the way a microwave oven heats water. Are you familiar with the way the mechanism at the molecular level, at the atomic level, how does the microwave oven, with its magnetic field and electric field, it's an electromagnetic wave, how does it heat the water, which means the water molecules, which are moving as a fluid, end up moving more rapidly. That's what heat means. They're now hotter. They've got a higher temperature. Are you familiar with how the atoms of water have a higher velocity when you turn on the microwave oven? Over to you, Wesley.
WHYY.
Joe recognized, but Wesley first. Go ahead, Wesley.
Well, we're dealing with the wavelengths rising from the electromagnetic waves, and then we have a very short wavelength. I believe it's somewhere in the vicinity of 200 megahertz, and then the if we take the wavelength, which is a millimeter wavelength, the boundaries. I'm trying to reward it properly, but it is the signals. They are roughly the same in dimensions, and they are somehow. Well, it's a good question. You got me in it. Back to you.
Yeah, I can tell that you're starting to move in the direction of water absorption by way of resonance. Good guess, and I say no. The very first microwave oven ran at 900 megacycles. The next one ran at 2,450 megacycles. Simply because that frequency was left over and it's available. The microwave energy in a microwave oven heats the water by dielectric phenomenon, which we haven't described yet, and it is not frequency sensitive. The first water vapor resonance is way up at 22 gigahertz, and we're feeding it at 2 gigahertz. So that's not it. I'll get to that in a minute. Over to you, to meet you all right. Joe, I know you want to make a comment. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, not directly about the subject, but I was listening for a while off and on. And I'm surprised nobody has mentioned anything about what the scientists over in Switzerland have recently done, I think either today, yesterday, or something like that, about their experiments with antimatter. And they're able to either view or investigate antimatter for a period of like 15 minutes, where normally it exists for only fractions of a second. And they said they did this at temperatures of like 1 degree above absolute zero. Back to you, Dick.
Now, when it comes to antimatter study, the LHC, Large Hadron Collider, was supposed to be involved in that, and that's in Switzerland. The CERN LHC, a 17-mile diameter, 27-kilometer diameter particle accelerator. I think that's not what you're talking about. You're now talking about a fraction of a degree Kelvin, very cryogenic temperatures, and antimatter. I'm hearing this for the first time. I'm a little bit behind the news. Give us a few more words. Which organization did this, Joe? You got it, Joe.
I think it was the organization you talked about in Switzerland. That's right near the French border, wherever this places. I was listening to it today as I was mowing the lawn, because I always wear headphones on when I mow the lawn, and they have an AM radio built in, and I have it tuned to 1010 winds, and it repeated it a couple of times today. I don't have any more details than that, but they just said for the first time they were able to actually study some form of antimatter, I guess related to hydrogen or something like that, I think, and they were able to study it for like a period of about 15 minutes, and they were doing this at a temperature of 1 degree above absolute zero. I said, I wonder if I'll hear that on TechNet.
We're using the term anti-hydrogen.
Yeah, we're
matter, not anti-hydrogen. I was paying. It was only like a clip that come on for like 10, 15 seconds on the news on 1010 Winds. So maybe I'll listen some more. Maybe I'll hear more about it tomorrow.
Yeah, we're a little behind the times on this one. So you think it was the CERN organization, the research organization of multinations in Switzerland on the French-Swiss border where the Large Hadron Collider is located. And so we've now got a significant experiment with antimatter. Are you about to tell me, Joe, that the matter-antimatter engines that they've been using on Star Trek is about to become a reality? Over to you, Joe.
Come on, Dick, come on. We're not in the 23rd century yet. I'll have to listen more about it during the week, and if there's something brought about it during the week I hear, any clip on the news, whatever, I'll mention it next week. But I'm sure you should listen to the news, too. 1010 Winds is a good source for this kind of stuff.
Let's see if John has heard about it. You got it, John.
No, I haven't heard about it, but I'm just wondering whether it was the large Hadron Collider or the tokamak bottle they had there. I know they're running two different types. It might have been the tokamak vessel.
But in the past, the tokamak is trying to reproduce the conditions in the center of the sun, which is a few million atmospheres and a few million degrees Kelvin simultaneously so that you get nuclear fusion. That doesn't sound cryogenic, but who knows? If something gets hot enough, it acts cold. I sort of doubt that. I wonder if you've heard anything about this one, Wesley.
We're here on the radio, but I was most of the time with John in the car, and we were having scientific discussions, but we were not paying attention to the radio. When they were mentioning the word anti-hydrogen, which kind of brought my attention, but no, I don't have, maybe anybody on this repeater heard this information and could relate it to us and to XGA.
I'm going to make a guess that the first material you work with as antimatter could have been the most basic element, hydrogen. So antimatter, hydrogen, may have been the first element they experimented with, and cryogenically. And so, you know, there's a big mystery as to the fact that everything we know about the Big Bang should have made an equal amount of matter and antimatter. And so the big question for us is, where in the world is all the antimatter? Is it in some other universe? Is it some other galaxy? We've seen no evidence of a particular galaxy that we can view being made out of antimatter. Although I'm not quite sure what you would look at in order to see it, because in theory, the radio signals, the radio astronomy signals you get from a matter universe and an antimatter universe, I think they would look the same. Mel, I know that you had to leave us early because you've got a great big meeting tomorrow, so maybe we'll turn it over to you, K2KEY, K2RIW in the group.
Just going to say goodnight to all fascinating subjects and all, and I read a lot of times in Discover magazine, and it's mind-boggling, some of the experiments, whether or not they're all taking place, but, oh boy, there's a lot of things to come, Dick. It's going to be a completely different world, I believe, most likely not in our lifetime, but I tell you something, if they don't blow it up, don't destroy this world some way or another. There are things that we can't even dream of right now that are going to be reality. Good night, all. Thank you very much, and hopefully we'll get together next week. This is K2KEY.
Good night, Mel. Hey, Mel, you and I have got to worry that we're going to live long enough to see the good stuff happening. And I think John is exactly our age, too. John, all three of us got to worry about living long enough to watch the good stuff. You got it, John.
That's right, Dick. And like you and Mel, we have to stay interested and appreciate what's happening right now. And that sort of gives us a tip for the future. I hope to see a lot more new things. And I know they're coming down the pipe. But I'm with you there.
Yeah, it reminds me of a set of jokes that went back and forth between me and a guy who I worked with for a while. Real interesting character. And the two of us went jointly on a patent application, which was granted, and the patent's in both of our names. And while we were working on this project, I was telling him, make sure that you eat a whole lot of vegetables and don't eat cholesterol and get enough sleep. We got to make sure, we were so wrapped up in this project, we got to make sure that we live long enough to see it through to fruition, to see it really work. And he has since had a heart attack, even though he was doing all the right things. Lots of exercise, eating just the right foods, but still had a heart attack. So it's worrisome. And I don't think he made some of what I think are discoveries about some of the things in our diet that seem very innocent, but they're not so innocent, salt being one of them. Okay, I'm convinced, getting back to the original subject, Wesley, that when you produce very strong cyclic voltages...
Let me interrupt you, because I feel ashamed that you got me into this subject. What I remember was that Spencer, who was in 1945 playing with it, and he accidentally found out that his chocolate that he had in the pocket bar, his chocolate bar melted. And he was standing about a high-density electromagnetic field. Does that rule with the heating of the food in a metal box?
That was Percy Spencer is the name of the guy who's in 1945-46 at Raytheon and eventually got connected with the Amana Food Company, or there was another company, but they made this radar range thing. His original story was that the chocolate bar melted in his pocket, and that gave him the idea. And the next thing he did was to cook a hot dog, I think it was. Many of these stories of explanation grow in magnitude or get distorted. Was it really a chocolate bar? I'm going to have to find out whether or not the rate of absorption of microwaves of ordinary chocolate, would it be appropriate? I mean, when we cook our food in a microwave oven, the majority of the cooking is the heating of the water. Water is a bipolar molecule. It takes a bipolar molecule to get the kind of heating we get in a microwave oven. And that bipolar molecule heating phenomena is not frequency sensitive. You can do it at 1 megacycle, 1,000 megacycles, 10,000 megacycles. All of those frequencies have from time to time been used as a kind of a microwave oven. So the frequency doesn't matter. That's not the phenomena. It's not resonance absorption and re-radiation. And will chocolate do that? Is chocolate made out of a bipolar molecule? That's what we've got to find out about. And if the answer is no, then the amount of heating of the chocolate could be extremely small compared to water. And therefore, the water in his chest would have been boiling before he would have melted that chocolate bar. There's a slim chance we'll find that out, that it really is an urban legend about the chocolate bar. He sensed heating. I, for one, have put my hand in front of a feed horn running high power, and I have felt the heat in my hand. So he probably felt the heat on his body long before the chocolate bar would have melted, I think. So I think it's an urban legend. We're going to try to confirm that. But the mechanism by which water gets heated, do you want to make a guess on that, John and Wesley, in that order? And maybe you've already heard my story on this one. KC2WGB, K2RIW.
No, that I'm not familiar with. I'm not going to hazard a guess. And by the way, I know you're a health-conscious guy, Dick. That's why I asked you about the wine question last week. I wanted to know if that was part of your regimen.
You wanted to know about the blank question. I missed one word there, John. Go ahead.
Last week I had asked you if you were a wine drinker, and I know you're a health regimented guy, and I was just wondering if that was part of your supplemental ingestion.
I think I have consumed about one cup of alcohol in the last decade. So no, I'm not a wine drinker. And the good stuff that's in wine, people keep coming up with good answers and bad answers about that. So although wine may be beneficial, I'm not getting the benefit of wine. Over to you, Wesley.
I think it makes the heating of water make something to do with the dipole movement, which would be that if we have a frozen water, the molecules of the water are not free to be rotated, and the same story is actually related to the materials containing glucoses, which is sugars, then the microwave heating is kind of resonance of the motor water molecules. Correct me if I'm wrong in this area.
You use the word resonance, and it is not resonance of the water molecule. Yes, the water molecule must be a bipolarity device. Before I give my explanation, are you saying that sugar is or is not a polar molecule?
Polar molecule.
Okay, I missed that. It is or is not a polar molecule?
It is a polar molecule.
Okay, then it says that sugar in liquid... Now, sugar is a polar molecule. Is that a sugar solution that's a polar molecule, or sugar as a crystalline form is a polar molecule? Back to you.
Any sugar base or any substance that is glucose's base is a polar molecule.
Okay, that's a good sign. Therefore, it will be heated in an oven, and there's certainly sugar in a chocolate bar, and therefore that portion of it could be heated. But now, when the chocolate bar is in solid form, are the sugar molecules free to move enough? And like you said earlier, the heating of ice with a microwave oven, I don't know the exact number, but I'll bet it's at least 1,000 times lower than liquid water. Liquid water molecules are a fluid, and just like air molecules are also a fluid, I don't know the exact number. I know that air molecules are moving very close to 500 meters per second average speed. Air molecules at room temperature are doing that. I think water molecules are moving a little bit faster than that, but it's something like 500 meters per second, which means that they're bumping into each other. You got to be careful how you use the word bumping, but they're bumping into each other at a fantastic rate. So they're bumping off of each other, deflecting off of each other, and water molecules also being bipolar, the positive end of one and the negative end of another, link up for short periods of time. Water molecules are continuously forming chains and breaking chains and bumping into each other. Very complicated process that gives you the skin effect and whatever on water. But because the individual water molecules in the microwave oven flip back and forth in polarity at the radio rate, and it doesn't matter if the radio rate is 1 megacycle or 10,000 megacycles, they are flipping back and forth trying to follow the local electrostatic field of that electromagnetic wave, the E field. They're trying to align themselves with the E field. Let me drop. And most of the models you've seen of a water molecule is a bumpy object. You've got an oxygen molecule in the center, and these two hydrogens hanging off to one side at something like 111 degrees separation between the two. So it's a bumpy molecule that is flipping back and forth in rotation at the radio rate. At the same time, they're bumping into each other. So it's kind of obvious that quite often when they bump into each other, they don't just bump into each other and simply bounce away. one molecule will be hit by the other molecule's bump while it's in rotation. Therefore, they come apart at a greater speed than they collided with each other, because the rotation is imparting the bumpiness, and the rotation is imparting extra velocity after the bump, a little bit like the ping pong paddle effect. So therefore, the water molecules end up moving faster after the bump when they bump into each other after the collision, because of the presence of the microwave oven, the microwave signal. That is the heating mechanism. It is a reasonably mechanical process created by the E-field creating the rotation. And so ice, being a crystalline structure where the molecules cannot rotate, cannot do that. And therefore ice is a very low loss material compared to water. K2LIW listening.
Yeah, well, as far as the resonance, Dick, I remember I have read somewhere, I believe there was a scientific paper, but it might be in many places, at 20 gigahertz, the water vapor is not immune to the resonance. Actually, the resonance by the microwave penetration is happening at the water vapor at higher frequencies. So 20 gigahertz is the range of the frequency that is responsible for it.
Oh, I agree. Water vapor, first resonance is around 22 gigahertz. Oxygen molecules, first resonance is around 60 gigahertz. So there's water with oxygen and hydrogen resonance frequencies. Hydrogen's got a resonance frequency around 1400. But the hydrogen is not free in the water, so I don't think that counts. So the microwave oven is not operating anywhere near 22 gigahertz, and the water is not in vapor form. And does water in liquid form have a similar resonance? I'm doubtful of that, but we'll find out eventually. Yeah. The water vapor, is that individual water molecules? I think the answer is yes. They're just not joined together anymore. But that's 22 gigs. So the heating of water in a microwave oven, I think, is essentially zero resonance phenomena. It's just a rotational phenomena, as long as the water is in non-crystalline form. That's what I believe is going on here. And so we got to find out if the sugar molecule is bipolar enough, and is it in liquid form? The sugar molecule
for the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
Is the sugar molecule in a liquid enough form in the solid chocolate of a bar to experience dielectric heating? I think it's time that I put a glass of water in a chocolate bar in my microwave oven and find out. K2RIW, over to you, Wes.
Yeah, I'm under the impression that the microwave cooking is made from inside out. But that may happen only if each molecule is generating the heat from inside and radiating it outward. Of cooking, there is a certain dependency in it, because the longer the wavelength, the more penetration to the food is happening. What's your sir?
There are lots of articles about a microwave oven saying it heats from the center out, which is not true. For every substance you're going to cook, steak, turkey, whatever, and for every frequency you might operate a microwave oven, there is a certain depth of penetration. And yes, it goes down a centimeter or two, and that's where it does the majority of the heating. But it doesn't necessarily go to the center. If I've got a great big roast beef, I'm not heating up the center first and then the outer. You don't get that much penetration. So yes, you're right. At lower frequencies, you get more penetration, and you would be heating closer to the center. But when I put a ice cube or a snowball in my microwave oven with a glass of water, the glass of water after 1 or 2 minutes, started to boil. The ice cube did nothing. The snowball did nothing. It's as if I had never turned on the microwave oven, and they were simultaneously in the same microwave oven on the same Lazy Susan turntable being rotated along with the glass of water. So I now have a lot more understanding for what goes on with the so-called defrost cycle of a microwave oven. The ice essentially does not cook. So you put a frozen hamburger in a microwave oven, and if you're not doing it in the defrost cycle, you're going to end up with little chunks of the hamburger overcooked alongside the other portions that are completely raw and frozen, and it's a very unpleasant rubbery mess. Wonder if you've ever heard similar stories, John. Over to you, John, K2RIW.
Yes, I have, Dick, and I also wondered that if the ice is not absorbing the microwaves, that's a little dangerous for the oven, I would believe. And I have a question also. As we raise the frequency of that microwave oven, does the heating effect happen at a quicker rate?
A good guess, but I'm not so sure. Yeah, what you're saying is that the molecules of the water are flipping back and forth faster at the higher rate. And does that make them heat more? It might. In other words, the lost tangent of water is frequency sensitive. I remember reading the book called Von Hippel, in which they talk about the lost tangent. In fact, that's all we got to do. If we go to Wikipedia and look up lost tangent of water versus frequency, we'll find out real fast, does water absorb heat faster? That's what greater lost tangent means, at higher frequencies. We'll find out real fast. Over to you, John.
Ah, that'd be a good query. Yes. That sounds interesting because it seems to be right, but I'm not sure of it.
We have a few minutes left. I was thinking about the multifactor effect and the random spurious effect that are happening in the vacuum tube, where the movement of the electron could cause, at certain conditions, the explosion of, in other words, let me put it this way. At a certain condition, the secondary electron emission in resonance with an alternating electric field has the exponential electron multiplication, and it might damage or destroy the device. If you can say a few words about that explosive character, N2XGF.
I think multipactor does not require resonance between the electrons and the object where it's taking place. You get a forced phenomenon because in the case of the S-band signal at 2.3 gigahertz, that was the S-band signal coming out of the Mercury capsule when this was first discovered, for this particular mission, so to speak. The forcing function was the signal coming out of the transmitter going into the dipole, which experienced the multipactor. And so the electrons were jumping back and forth. Because the signal was at 2.3 gigs, the electrons were jumping back and forth at 2.3 gigs. If the signal was at 5 gigs, the multipactor electrons would have been jumping back at 5 gigs, as long as they, the two elements of the dipole are close enough together and they could make the trip in that period of time. So it isn't really a atomic resonance that's required for multipactor. It's just a strong enough E-field with materials that are close enough together in a good enough vacuum, and the materials themselves have what's called the right work function. In other words, as electrons hit them, they will give up, as electrons hit the solid material, they will give off secondary electrons at a great enough rate. That's all that's required for multifactor. So I don't think it's a resonance phenomenon. Let me drop for a second. One other thing I was going to say. And John, and that is when you put the hamburger in the microwave oven that's frozen, the microwave oven does not think it's empty. It may think it's almost empty, but those microwaves bounce back and forth